this is just the first of, I think, many surprises and twists that are going to come our way over the next few months.
One expert's view of what lies ahead prior to a Trump-Kim meeting. This is Thursday, May 17th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Join us, please. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also coming your way, a man released from a Malaysian prison could be in line to be its leader. What is really happening is the Taliban attack in Afghanistan. Stay with us for that. And the U.S. president speaks out about a call for leniency for a Chinese communications company. It is all on today's VOA Asia. That would be VOA Asia. The White House is taking a wait-and-see approach on whether next month's Singapore summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place after Pyongyang expressed sharp reservations about U.S. demands that it dismantle its nuclear weapons program. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders met with reporters outside the White House Wednesday.
This is something that we fully expected. The president is very used and ready for tough negotiations. And if they want to meet, we'll be ready. And if they don't, that's okay, too. We'll continue with the campaign of maximum pressure if that's the case. But like I just said, if they want to meet, the president will certainly be ready. And we will be prepared. But if not, that's okay.
The fate of the summit was thrown into doubt after North Korea First Vice Foreign Minister Kim Kai-kwan said Pyongyang will have to reconsider whether to take part in the summit if the United States continues to demand that the regime unilaterally abandon its nuclear weapons arsenal. Kim said North Korea will not be interested in the Trump-Kim summit if Washington tries to push us unilaterally into a corner and force us to give up nukes. We welcome to VOA Asia Dr. Paul Evans, professor at the University of British Columbia, teaching Asian and Trans-Pacific Affairs. Paul, are you surprised that this has happened?
The specifics of what has transpired in the last 2 days does make me surprised. However, that there were going to be bumps, twists, turns on this peace train on the Korean Peninsula is no surprise. There are major constituencies that do not want these things to move ahead, or at least are uncertain where this train might be moving, and that the twists and turns before we get to the negotiating table, much less what happens afterwards, this is just the first of, I think, many surprises and twists that are going to come our way over the next few months.
Let's get a little specific here. You know that National Security Advisor John Bolton recently talked publicly about the Libyan decision to denuclearize during the Bush administration as a model for U.S. policy on North Korea. The White House has since downplayed those comments a bit after a North Korean official said Bolton's remarks were indicative of an awfully sinister move to imperil the Kim regime. Is that one of the motivating factors, as you see it?
There are a number of players, both, I suspect, on the on the North Korean side, but certainly in the United States, who have varied opinions on what denuclearization means, when it needs to be put in place, whether it's a precondition for other assistance and other diplomatic actions with the North. And Mr. Bolton's comments are indicative of one set of opinions about a formula that he feels must be put in place before serious discussions with North Korea can take place. Unfortunately, the president seems to be signaling something else. And so inevitably, there is going to be confusion and mixed signals that are going out from Washington towards Pyongyang. And I don't think we should overlook the possibility that there are some mixed signals coming from Pyongyang, too. We don't know. One of the dealing with North Korea, exactly who's pulling the strings is difficult to tell. But I think we have to work from the assumption that there are people with different views there as well. And there have been people in their military, in part of the party, who for their entire lives have built their careers and their expectations for their country around ongoing confrontation with the United States and have seen the nuclear weapons program as the ultimate way for regime survival. Some of the positive things that Kim Jong-un has been saying clearly did not fit well with everyone in his system. Now, how you interpret an American-South Korean military exercise, was it something from the past that was history and we move into a new era, or is it something that complicates the current moment? Those cheery thoughts of Kim Jong-un are not necessarily shared by those who see this as an opportunity to throw a couple of bricks in the road.
Do you expect to see this process go forward?
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm skeptical about where this is going. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays looks a little bit better. I think on balance that the presidents and the senior leaders are sufficiently committed that they will do everything they can to overcome these obstacles and get that meeting between Trump and Kim in place in June in Singapore. I'm optimistic that meeting can happen. What happens after that, how far these divisions, internal divisions, uncertainties, lack of trust, historical analogies that are being brought in, and when in the U.S. the Congress gets more involved and other players, then I think the game is multiplied by 100 in complexity, and heaven help the diplomats that want this to move forward.
Dr. Paul Evans, professor of Asian and Trans-Pacific Affairs at the University of British Columbia. He spoke with us from Vancouver via Skype. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. North Korean threats to step away from denuclearization talks are not slowing down planned military exercises between the United States and South Korea. Experts say the Philippine president's offer of work and possible amnesty to holdouts from a violent Muslim rebel group may bring momentary calm to an embattled southern island there. A police officer has been killed in an attack on a police outpost on Indonesia's Sumatra Island Wednesday. Four of the attackers were killed by police. Bangladesh's Supreme Court upholds a lower court's decision to grant bail to former Prime Minister Khalid Zia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. Malaysian police have raided the home of the former Prime Minister Najib Razak, reportedly searching for documents as part of a renewed probe into a corruption scandal involving a state investment fund. More than a dozen police vehicles were seen at Najib's house shortly after he returned home from prayers at a nearby mosque late Wednesday. Najib has virtually been under house arrest since he lost the general election last week. Police have limited access to his road, and the former leader and his wife are forbidden to leave the country. The jailed Malaysian politician Anwar Ibrahim is a free man after being granted a full pardon Wednesday following last week's dramatic electoral surprise May 9th that brought a 92-year-old Mahathir Mohamad out of retirement to become prime minister. Anwar had been serving a 5-year term for sodomy. He said the charge was politically motivated by the just-defeated government of Najib Razak.
In my case, we appealed because there was a miscarriage of justice. We appeal because there was travesty of justice. We appeal because there was clear conspiracy to condemn me, assassinate my political character. Now, there is a new dawn for Malaysia. I must thank the people of Malaysia, regardless of race and religion, who stood by the principles of democracy and freedom. They demand change, and it is our duty now to ensure that this mandate given to Pakatan Harapan would honor this commitment.
The question now is, what role will Anwar play amid speculation he's angling to replace Mr. Mahathir as prime minister? Longtime Malaysia watcher Clive Kessler, professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales, told VOA's Victor Beattie the full pardon means Anwar will not have to wait 5 years to re-enter politics.
He will be eager to contest a by-election to get into the House of Parliament. He will be eager, I imagined to take over from Dr. Mahathir, while Dr. Mahathir, I think, was looking forward to having a year or two until Anwar was ready to take over. So there could be a bit of tension between the two of them. Anwar's own family said that he probably would need and was looking forward to a bit of a rest to recuperate physically and otherwise. There's also a sense that to get the new government established, Dr. Mahathir carries more authority, is less polarizing, and is a surer hand on the levers of power to establish the new regime. Anwar is a little bit more polarizing, but Anwar's own followers will be very, very eager to get him in the top job sooner rather than later. But there are those who express a certain preference for Dr. Mahathir on the grounds that although Dr. Mahathir is an old authoritarian, Dr. Mahathir is, in religious terms, an Islamic Protestant. He believes in the supremacy of the religious conscience of every individual and really detests the old ulama religious establishment, whereas Anwar, some people fear, is more of a soft Islamist who will be more amenable to influence from stronger, more hardline Islamist influences.
Well, what makes this story so fascinating is that these two, Mahathir and Anwar, are old political rivals.
They were old friends, they were old rivals, but there's something quintessentially Malay about this, that you can fight to the death, but then suddenly it means nothing. They decide it's over, and they somehow or other they write it off.
Here's what's happening now in Asia. Japan passes a law to get more women into politics. Philippine senators ask their Supreme Court to invalidate President Duterte's withdrawal from the ICC. Reports say families behind Indonesia bombings belong to the same religious study group. Satellite photos reveal North Korea has begun dismantling its nuclear test site. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. Afghan security forces reestablished full government control Wednesday over the capital of western Farah province a day after the Taliban insurgency came close to capturing the city near the Iranian border. A major coordinated assault on early Tuesday had enabled the insurgents to enter Farah and take control of key government installations, including police and intelligence headquarters. Joining us by Skype is Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington. Michael, there are reports of other attacks in Afghanistan as well. What's behind this latest surge by the Taliban?
The conventional answer is that the spring fighting season is in full swing, that the Taliban typically intensifies its fighting once the weather warms up in Afghanistan each year. So I think that's part of it. But quite frankly, I think there are other factors at play, too. I think that what we've been seeing a lot more of over the last few months is the ability of the Taliban to really wage increasingly aggressive offensives in areas to the west and the north of Afghanistan, in great part because they're able to take advantage of a lack of effective security. You have very poor policing in many rural areas of Afghanistan outside of urban spaces, and the Taliban is simply able to, unfortunately, gain the trust of local communities, and that then allows them to develop a footprint and use these to develop a foothold and use these footholds for bigger offensives on the battlefield against Afghan troops and also in urban spaces, which we've seen in Farah province over the last few days, where for a very brief period you did have the Taliban controlling some government facilities in the provincial capital.
What is the U.S. doing about this? There had been talk and some action, I do believe, about trying to train and beef up Afghan security. Where does that stand?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the essence of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan now, is to try to make the Afghan fighting forces better than they are so that they can prevent these types of Taliban offenses all over the country. But, you know, as you know, this has been the U.S. policy for many years in this war, and certainly the capacities of the Afghan security forces have improved, but I would argue that ever since U.S. combat forces left Afghanistan at the end of 2014, putting the Afghan security forces on the front line of this insurgency, you know, we've just seen a big struggle from these Afghan soldiers. Just seems to be getting worse and worse, unfortunately.
What's the answer here?
Well, I mean, this is why the war in Afghanistan is such a policy conundrum. There really are no good options. I mean, I think staying in Afghanistan, if you have U.S. forces stay in Afghanistan and try to fight it out, that's going to be hard, because I think we've learned that this is a war that cannot be won militarily. So the other option is to leave entirely, and I don't think that would happen, because that would make Afghanistan really fall apart. So that leaves the third option, which is also not ideal because it's so remote, I would argue. And that is to try to find ways to get the Taliban to stop fighting, step off the battlefield, and agree to a negotiation. I really see no easy or good solutions for how to deal with this ongoing stalemate and this unending war in Afghanistan.
That's Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington. He joined us via Skype. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Now this news alert from VOA Asia. One survey shows South Koreans more worried about air pollution than Kim's nukes. Chinese President Xi Jinping expresses support for dialogue between North Korea and the United States. The Japanese government is making arrangements to inform the World Trade Organization of its readiness to take retaliatory steps against U.S. tariff actions. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump says the United States has little to give in contentious trade talks with China, and Beijing has a lot to give, because he says the United States for years has been losing trade battles with China. Wednesday, he defended his call to rescue China's giant technology company, ZTE, which the U.S. Commerce Department last month barred from buying American-made components for its consumer products for 7 years after it was caught violating U.S. trade bans with Iran and North Korea. ZTE said with the cut in U.S. parts, it had ceased major operating activities. The U.S. and China, the world's two biggest economies, are in the midst of contentious trade talks this week in Washington after Trump threatened to impose higher tariffs on $150 billion worth of Chinese exports, and Beijing responded in kind to say it would impose higher levies on American products. Earlier, talks in Beijing proved fruitless. Imagine storing digital data in DNA, wearing a device that makes you smarter, or creating new materials by manipulating the genes of microbes. They may sound like science fiction, but scientists are working on these technologies that combine what they know about biology and altering it with the help of artificial intelligence. Their work was presented at the Milken Institute Global Conference at a panel called Things That Will Blow Your Mind. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
The experiments conducted at this lab would not have been possible just a few years ago, says co-founder of Zymergen, Joshua Hoffman.
The machine finds stuff in the biology the human would never find.
Zymergen uses computers to design experiments that manipulate the genes of microbes so the chemicals they produce can make stronger or better materials.
We use automation and machine learning to engineer microbes, little single-cell creatures, to turn them into the chemical factories of the future. I would say the bulk of our work is with chemical and materials and with agricultural companies. We can work to increase the effectiveness of crop protection agents, so herbicides, fungicides, those sorts of things.
Instead of enhancing microbes, theoretical neuroscientist Vivian Ming speaks extensively about improving the human brain.
What I'm interested in is cognitive neuroprosthetics. Can I literally jam something in your brain and make you smarter? How much you can think about, pay attention to, mentally operate on at any given moment, we've actually found that we can increase that by about 15%.
Labs around the world are already conducting research on different types of external, non-invasive brain stimulation some of which could improve the brain's cognitive abilities. Ming says one application is to level the playing field for underprivileged children.
For that hour that they may be spending in a remedial class, we might actually be able to use a technology that brings them right back up with the rest of the kids.
In the early 1900s...
Inspired by biology, Hyungjun Park and his company Catalog make synthetic DNA used to store digital data.
We, as a society, are generating so much data with 5G wireless networks, Internet of Things, high-definition video, and just social media. By the year 2025, we're going to generate a lot more data and a lot more useful data than we'll have the capacity to store. And so we are in need of a new medium that can be much more efficient than the current solutions.
Park says, in contrast to current forms of data storage, DNA can store much more information that can last thousands of years. And Park's company has figured out how to do it less expensively than other labs.
It's a liquid solution that you move around to assemble different pieces of DNA. And then for storage, we would dry that down so that it's a powder in any tube that you were storing it in.
As scientists from various subfields of biology take advantage of artificial intelligence, investors are paying attention.
These traditional investors in the Silicon Valley area that's been invested in investing in tech companies that are now looking at biotech and seeing this as really the future of innovation.
Innovations that turn science fiction into scientific fact. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. A new global health plan is being rolled out by the World Health Organization and a health initiative called Resolve to Save Lives. The goal, to prevent 500,000 people a year from dying of heart disease. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
You can't see it in your food, and you can't taste it, but it can kill you. It's a man-made oil commonly called trans fat.
Trans fat is a toxic chemical that has been added to our food supply and accounts for an estimated more than 500,000 deaths every year.
Donuts, pastries, and snack foods often contain trans fats. Trans fats are used in restaurants and in street food. They're cheap, they last longer than natural oils, and they're easy to use in baked goods.
Trans fat is tasteless. It's solid at room temperature, but it's also solid at body temperature in your coronary arteries.
Trans fats raise bad cholesterol and cause fatal heart attacks. 3/4 of the world's deaths from cardiovascular disease happen in low and middle-income countries, according to the World Health Organization. Wealthy countries, including the U.S., have banned these fats or are in the process of banning them because of their connection to heart disease. Where trans fats have been banned, heart attacks and deaths from heart disease have dropped significantly. The WHO has called for banning trans fats before, but now the plan calls for governments to develop plans to replace trans fats with healthier oils such as olive oil, to create public awareness of the harms of trans fats, and to enforce anti-trans fat policies and laws. If this happens, more than 17 million lives will be saved over the next 25 years, and a major source of heart disease will be eliminated. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for listening to our program today at VOA Asia. Get it on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you at VOA Asia Facebook. Also our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Rob McLean, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.